Hey, everybody. Well, this week has been kind of crazy. We did a live episode earlier in the week on Monday, and then that obviously dropped, the 200th episode. That was also the episode that came right after getting a Hugo nomination, which is really cool. So thank you all again for nominating us, for listening, all that good stuff. I did want to say a few things about the Worldcon fundraiser. Right now, I basically have the funding for the flight. That's a new development. I got some external donations that are going to take care of the flight part based on the cost. However, there was a change that the individual who had offered their hotel unfortunately had to pull out for reasons that I imagine don't need to be public. So that means that that cost now has to be covered, which sucks, but it doesn't actually change the end goal. It just switches out for me the cost of the flight because anyway, there's a whole other thing about that. But in any case, so right now I have that. The only thing I just need is living expenses and food, that kind of stuff. So I've extended the deadline just a little bit, just to give a little more time, mostly because this other stuff is not as immediate in need. I don't need it like right away because it's going to be a couple months anyway. So I moved it till the end of next month. But in any case, if you can donate, that'd be really awesome. There's going to be lots of perk stuff. So things like that are going to happen. So yeah, I'm going to shut up on that. Do check out the blog. There's lots of cool stuff on the blog. And yeah, just go to skiffingfandy.com. You can see all the details about the fundraiser on the side. There's a little button. So I'm going to shut up and let you get to the episode. Enjoy.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing. Yes. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, a Shoot the Wiz subcast. I'm Sean.
I'm Mike.
I'm Paul.
I'm David.
And I'm Stina.
And we have a special guest today. Our special guest is Daniel Huddleston. Hi, Daniel.
Hello.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. I'm an assistant English teacher. I live in Japan and do Japanese to English science fiction translations on the side.
So you picked this movie. You gave me a whole bunch of options, and then we kind of narrowed it down to one director, and then we picked the one that basically you said was a little more rigorous. So I'm just curious, from your perspective, why did you kind of want to go with this particular film?
Well, of his three movies, since he's kind of become a name director in Japan, I guess I felt that this is the one that might give us the most to talk about in terms of its science fiction themes, its social themes. If we're going to be talking for an hour, the movie we're talking about is Summer Wars, directed by Mamoru Hosoda.
And he's probably better known for The Girl Who Leapt Through Time by some people. This may not be as well known. Well, it's still pretty well known, I think, but Variety says it's spectacular, visionary, and staggering. So, that's a pretty big. It's on the whatever you like DVD case or whatever you call it. So apparently, Variety really liked it. So you think that this is perhaps gives us a little bit more because I haven't seen The Girl Left Through Time, so perhaps offers a little bit more of the social atmosphere that is worth discussing.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah, The Girl Who Leapt Through Time, it's a really nice character piece, and something of a love story too, but it also is, as a plot, it's pretty straightforward. So I was just thinking about, as far as interesting themes that might help sustain a discussion.
Okay.
Just from that perspective.
Sure. Well, why don't we start then by just getting sort of like a general sort of reactions, things that we would like to discuss. And I think I'm just going to go in order from what it now looks like on my screen. Your name's all moved around weird. But Mike, you are still first, so I'm going to start with you. Just sort of a general reaction, something you'd like to start us off with.
Sure. I took a look at the trailer when we were discussing that we were going to do this, and I expected the Oz aspects because those came out really, really quickly in the trailer. But then what really struck me by the film is how it is definitely a family saga, and that you've got this big multi-generational aspect, and it's a very wide cast. And we have kind of our heroes and heroines within that cast, but that it's really a whole family story, and that it goes very broad on that, which I found quite interesting. And, you know, little character notes here and there, as well as our leads and kind of a... So we've got layers of activity and plot lines that are interconnected. And it's a good kind of speculation forward from a world where we have like Second Life and Twitter and Facebook. If all of those merged in together, I was also reminded a bit of Ready Player One, though I think this came out slightly before that, kind of adds into that that question of what is the internet moving toward and what does that leave us exposed to? Which then the film digs into, and we still get some action adventure elements. So a lot to think about and talk about. I was not as blown away as maybe I'd been primed to be, but I think it was quite good.
Well, I want to jump on to something that I'm sure we'll all have something to say about the rather large cast and the family elements. I'll have something to say, but I did want to talk about that. Though I think that there's some aspects of this film where its handling of its technological aspect, I think, maybe borrows a little bit too much from maybe sort of like action-oriented anime. I'm saying that as somewhat of a novice, but at the same time, I did like that it sets up fairly early on and actually uses this element for part of its sort of plot or its main conflict, which this idea that Oz is this all-encompassing system that millions, hundreds of millions of people are now using. That also is connected to all of these other systems that we need. So, I mean, it's connected to, you know, our nuclear power facilities and to, you know, presumably our light systems for cars and navigation tools. Like, basically that this is, it's shown to us in very clever ways throughout the film how ubiquitous this technology is. I mean, there's a point at which one of the characters is like, my GPS machine is no longer working. I don't know if I'm going to be able to get to the house because this sense that they've just lost touch with what, you know, would have been in the old days, you'd actually have to read a freaking map. But like, I appreciate that because it, of course, adds a bit of a dire note to what sometimes is very comical, you know, because there is a lot of that comedy element, particularly with the sort of romance subplot. But it adds that sort of sense of dread that, no, this is actually a world-changing thing. It's not just some silly thing that a bunch of teenage kids are dealing with. No, this is actually a huge, huge conflict. And I just appreciated the technological aspect. I thought that was really cool. So, nobody put up a hand. I could talk for another 12 hours, but...
No.
Paul, why don't you jump in? All right.
I wanted to continue that discussion and highlight of Oz as what Second Life wants to be and hasn't quite managed. Once upon a time, I used to spend a fair amount of time in Second Life, and I wrote for a Second Life magazine, and I kept thinking, like, this is when they were talking about commerce and all the things that Oz basically taking over the internet. It's like I kept thinking this is what Second Life really wants to be, down to the point where there are places in Second Life where you can role play and where you can have, well, not quite the combats that we see in some wars, but there are places where people do beat each other up with their avatars. And I just kept thinking, this is what would the world would be like if Second Life took over the internet. And that disturbed me because, well, it makes one point of failure and just having the AI squat on top of it mucks up a lot of things for everyone. And I noticed that even until the point where the satellite is going to be directed to Earth, this is a relatively bloodless internet failure. I mean, the great grandmother passes away, but otherwise we don't hear about anybody else dying or losing their life over this. And I'm not sure whether the director was pulling his punches or it was implied that just the great grandmother's efforts helped avert catastrophe. And I kept wondering, what about the rest of the world? Okay, she's got Japan, but what about all the tens of millions of people in the U.S.? I was just imagining traffic jams, heart attacks, all sorts of things that we don't see and aren't even implied. And that just struck me as like, this is relatively bloodless, except for the fact that a nuclear reactor is going to explode because of a falling satellite.
Okay, well, Daniel, you seemed like you were typing earlier. Did you want to jump in?
Oh, I was getting a hand ready if I needed it.
Okay. Do you want to go now?
Okay. Yeah, well, like Paul was saying, I think at the very end of the movie, there was a line that they were saying that there were no deaths reported as a result of this. But, of course, you know, people in hospitals, planes in flight, I mean, you know, that scandal with the bridge closing in New Jersey, I think, even that had, I think, one fatality linked to it.
Yeah.
Because an ambulance was caught in traffic and couldn't get where it was going in time. So, yeah, if this happened in the real world, I think there would be a much bigger mess than what was shown in the movie.
I do just add a quick thing. Which it was implied, I think, when the grandmother dies that because of all the failures in the system that it didn't alert the authorities that she was, like, dying. But I think it's very muted in the film. It's sort of mentioned once, but then nobody really has a discussion about it in relation to what's happening in the world. But I remember that being mentioned. So it does seem kind of odd because, you know, you think that would like as Daniel was saying, you know, even with the like Brooklyn Bridge example, like this would have an impact that it seems like the film doesn't want to deal with. And I think maybe that has a lot to do with that. The real heroes of this or the main characters are teenagers. And in some sense, this is, I think either it's intentionally a comedy or it's kind of a comedy. But maybe I'm wrong on that. And maybe David wants to say something since he put up a hand. So why don't you jump in, David?
Well, I think it's partly it's the tone of the film. I mean, it's ultimately a very lighthearted movie, and it's not really interested in giving us a bloody apocalypse triggered by a global internet meltdown. It presents that as a threat, but the death of the great grandmother is certainly directly attributed to the activities of the Love Machine virus. In fact, there's even a hint watching it this time. I think that she might have been targeted specifically because we see Love Machine focus on an icon that we then see on her robe. Yeah. I think, I mean, one of the things I find, we also get in the film is this whole series of binary oppositions where we're seeing these opposites that are linked where we have both the macro hint of the world breaking down, but the micro in that it's all a very intimate story just with this one family and everything seems to be coming out of there or being dealt with this one group. Mm-hmm. And then we get these further subdivisions. I mean, you also get, Sean, when you mentioned the technology, right? Somebody being dependent on GPS and before they would have used a map. And there's that sense too of tradition versus modernity or postmodernity and the uneasy coexistence or perhaps the melding of the two. And then of course there's the male female breakdowns, which also get set along a kind of tradition light. I mean, we note that I mean, other than the great grandmother and a little bit Natsuki at the end, the female roles are almost entirely sidelined. Like they're all working in the kitchen or, you know, getting the funerals ready and so on. And all of the stuff that moves the plot forward is happening with the male characters, even who are in fact being presented as reclaiming some kind of masculine failed masculinity as if they weren't active enough before. Started to me read as a kind of nostalgia for the past that had also been replaced by this internet. I mean, it gets problematized slightly by the great grandmother's powerful presence as an anchor. But there's, I think, some pretty stark divisions there that put almost all of the agency in the male characters.
Hmm. Well, I see Daniel had his hand up first, and then we'll go to Mike. So, Daniel, what did you want to jump in with?
Right. As far as the great-grandmother being targeted by Love Machine, there. Watching it last night, when he first starts his rampage, you see him like knocking around icons in the background. You know, he knocks around the traffic icons, and then you see the traffic going crazy and so on. And then the great-grandmother, she gets on the phone. She starts encouraging everybody. She sort of musters the troops by telephone. And there's a shot of those scattered icons slowly, you know, coming back into order.
Hmm.
And then you get the shot of Love Machine specifically looking down a list of family crests, and he stops on the Jinnochi family crest. And yes, that was immediately after that. You see that on it's printed on the kimono on the great grandmother's back. So,
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, and the way it was set up, I believe one of the sons was a doctor, and it was set up so that whatever technology was monitoring the mother's condition was set up so that if something went wrong, a message was supposed to be sent to the son through Oz. So he would get it on his cell phone and know something was wrong right away. But because Love Machine interfered with that, he didn't get it in time.
Mm. Mike, you are next.
I'm going to pass to Stina.
Okay, Stina, go.
Oh, okay. Well, I have to say, I'm an animation major, and oddly enough, I'm not usually a big fan of anime, largely because of certain tropes that I don't enjoy. And this one managed to avoid almost all of those tropes that I don't enjoy. On top of that, I really loved the great grandmother. I thought that was a fantastic touch. Usually older women in any kind of story are immediately sidelined. Immediately. They aren't even mentioned. They don't even exist in story. So for me, it was really positive to see that going on. Although the main female character was mainly there as kind of a romance figure. But that didn't bother me so much because we had the great grandmother. You know what I mean? But I was set to actually not like this, and I actually really did like it. So I wanted to make sure that I made that point. But yes, I agree with the gender politics that were stated previously. It's just that usually that is not undercut by other things that were present.
Mm-hmm.
So it made it more palatable, if that makes sense. So anyway, yeah. That's what I wanted to put in. Michael, go ahead.
Yeah, something I thought was very interesting in this film that I haven't seen as much in other anime that are set in the kind of the modern era. And most of my anime watching was like 97 through 2003 and then little chunks since. So I'm definitely missing some things. But the family, the Jinnochi, are explicitly descendants of samurai. And that they are old, like they were old money, and then they've lost most of it. So that means that this family is an even more exaggerated kind of test case and contrast using the binaries that David has been talking about in positioning tradition versus modernity. And that Oz's corruption is the excess of hypermodernity as exaggerated by the character who we meet, who's kind of the instigator. And has the relationship with Love Machine, avoiding spoilers here, so that it was interesting for me to see that samurai heritage and that history so frequently and specifically invoked, and how that counterpointed with the hypermodernity of especially Kazma who is the kind of Oz native in the family.
Paul?
Yeah, I do wonder, picking up from something Mike said, how that tradition versus modernity and this old family place in Japan versus place here. From my perspective, being an outsider, was like interesting invented history and how this clan has interacted with Japanese history through time. And we keep getting the stories about them fighting larger and larger battles and getting defeated. I wonder how, maybe Daniel can speak this, how it was received and how it plays in Japan to have this sort of invented history dropped into the matrix of real Japanese history.
Hmm. Oh, man.
Yeah, go, Dan. Yeah, no, yeah.
Okay. Japanese people typically don't, even the ones that are descended from samurai, typically don't brag about it, because all of that was abolished long ago, and it's really that the whole kind of Bushido code, the samurai ethos, that kind of got blamed for the militarism that got them into World War II. So there was a stark turning away from that. So it's, but I guess I can imagine within a family, not bragging outside the family, but within the family, maybe they're still quite proud of their lineage and where they came from. Let's see, I had a thought. Well, I'll pass for the moment.
Okay. Why don't we have David jump in, fill in?
I guess further on that, the family here also, they seem to be largely failed samurai, right? They have that one battle that they won, but otherwise when they were arrived in this land, it was not very good land. They lost a lot of the battles that they had in the past, so it becomes almost a sense of fail again, fail better. They of standing up for what for the traditions they believe in, even if they also know that they often lose, and they're almost kind of a beautiful losers sort of thing. But and then too, regarding the tradition, are we avoiding spoilers altogether here, or are we doing our usual assuming that everybody's seen the movie as we carry on? Just before I go into a spoiler.
I guess I could jump in on this since we're talking about the family. Because I thought it was really interesting that I know we already talked about this sort of like the gender split, like the women are mostly in the kitchen, except the one woman who's watching her son play baseball, which I thought was really interesting, the way the film paired what's going on in this sort of the Oz world and this baseball game. They're happening side by side, and like for some strange reason, everyone's oblivious to what's happening in the world at the baseball game. But hey, whatevs, it's all good. It's cute. But it's a good pairing. But I did like that. You know, these two groupings, like the men and the women, are separated for so much of the film, but actually in the end, they all come together, and they're all just sort of working basically towards the same goal, which is defeat this giant mutated AI.
Exactly. I actually really loved that. Sorry.
Oh, no. I loved it, too. I thought it was really great because it's not the opposition, because there is that moment at which the women are saying, essentially, we need to, deal with the dead granny, and we need to, that's the thing we should be focused on. We should not be thinking about this other stuff. We have this very important task at hand. And a certain segment of the men, at least, are like, no, we have to fight, particularly the one guy, I forgot which one he is. He's like the uncle who constantly talks about, as David was mentioning, those battles that most of which they've lost. But he's just like really gung ho. We got to like defeat this AI. But of course they come together in the end. And it actually, oh my God, what is her name? The main, teen girl. Shoot.
Natsuki.
Yeah. And she sort of becomes actually a part of it becomes an integral part to basically the success of the whole thing, which I really appreciated. Because they could have just not had it. They could have just had Kenji be, that would have been the end of it. Kenji and the little kid.
Kazuma.
Yeah. He's a badass, but yeah. But anyway, so I see, Paul, you wanted to jump in, so go for it.
Yeah, just as a side note, it seemed to me in watching it that the baseball game seemed to be directly paralleling the events in the plot. As the team and his pitcher and the family's connected to the baseball team, as at least as far as I understand, as they were progressing and struggling through their tournament, so were the main characters struggling in the fight against the AI. And it just seemed to be parallel point for point for point as they get victories and have to go into overtime, so to speak, or extra innings against the AI to try to overcome it. The baseball game basically is a shorthand for how they're doing against the AI at any particular moment, and complete with a victory at the end. I guess I did spoil, but I don't think people are going to watch this thinking that humans lose and everyone dies, but I'm not sure that's much of a spoiler.
It's not that kind of a film.
Evangelion has a really weird ending. Just saying. Just leave it there. I think, Daniel, you had a hand up, so why don't you jump in?
Yeah. Michael has a comment. A baseball game is visual Greek chorus. Absolutely. Actually, that tournament that's going on television is a big deal in Japan every summer. It's kind of a part. There's a lot of interesting things that go on in the summertime in Japan. They're almost symbolic of summer. They mention in the movie. They mention, I think, watermelons, firework displays, and that baseball tournament, the national high school baseball tournament at Koshien Stadium, which is near Kobe. That's a big deal every year, and there are local tournaments held in every prefecture to send their representative team to the nationals. The local tournaments are broadcast locally on television from start to finish, and the national tournament is broadcast nationwide. Every single game of it. So, yeah, the lady in the movie, she's got her son is a pitcher and he's trying to get to the national tournament. And I just wanted to mention that because the Koshien tournament is it's a huge part of, I guess, what makes summer summer in Japan.
Interesting.
She's a Red Sox fan. You saw her shirt.
A lot of the uniforms kind of copy Major League uniforms.
Mike, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, and that ties into directly to the title, the Summer Wars. Not Summer War singular, it's multiple wars. It's the conflict within the family, it's the baseball tournament, it's the combat in Oz, it's, you know, Wabusuke and Natsuki, their struggle to find a place within their family, that all of this resonates kind of across these different layers of the story, which I thought was really fun.
David?
And that seems to be where the film wants to be going by the end, with bringing all of the different oppositions that we've seen and all the separations that we've had so much of. There's this plea for unity, I guess, that there's this gigantic, ever-expanding cooperation that it finally is necessary on both the micro and the macro level to defeat Love Machine.
I mean, I guess I would jump in. I really thought too. There's this interesting aspect of what Mike was saying with the wars, and particularly the family conflict. Because I'm just forgetting all kinds of names because it's been a long day. So I'm sorry, but the outcast adopted son, what is his name?
Wabusuke.
Yeah, where he sort of returns. And he actually, of course, is largely responsible for, or at least partially responsible for what's happening here. And that the conflict with him, and he sort of is at the center, I think, in many respects, for the conflict with the family, because he's somewhat been, I guess, dishonorably discharged because he's stolen money from Granny and gone off. But of course, what he's done is he's hoped to actually restore his honor by doing something great. Of course, the ironically, what he's done may have actually ended up with killing the grandmother.
He didn't steal the money. Grandma gave it to him.
Did the grandma give it to him?
Yeah.
Yes.
I was in the impression he took it.
Nope.
That was the family twisting the reality against him because they all have a grudge.
I don't know if I'd believe that.
Stina's right.
See? She gave him the money. That was the thing. That was the twist, the plot twist, is that, you know, hey, he's the bad guy, but oops, she funded him. I distinctly remember that.
Yeah.
Look, I'm just going to choose to believe what I want to believe. So,
you're wrong.
Look, whatever I believe is, it's up to me. I'm just going to continue to believe that he's evil. So, you can just deal with it.
He's also the product of he's non-traditional himself, right? In that he's the illegitimate son of I saw a family tree once. He's the illegitimate son of the grandmother's deceased son, right?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I appreciated that was at the center of the conflict, and it attempts to resolve that, but in a really carefully crafted way, instead of just sort of making it simplistic or just sort of just throwing him out and being done with it. He actually sort of has to be integrated back into the family unit via basically being participating in this big event, which I thought was great. I also love that there's like giant ice cubes in a room with this like enormous like computer machine of some description. So that was all, but in any case, that's kind of the thing that I was interested in. I don't have anything else on that. And there are no hands, so somebody has to talk.
Okay. At the school where I work, actually, I've always thought this is kind of interesting. For English composition, there's a question that students are asked every year to write about. And, they're asked what they prefer. A traditional three-generation family or a nuclear family? And the students' replies are always very interesting because some of them will say, well, I think a nuclear family is better because basically three generations of people don't have to put up with each other and people have more freedom to do what they want. But there's a lot of students that say, they kind of look at the nuclear family, which is as baseline as you can get for Americans. They look at that as kind of the newfangled, oh, I'm not so sure of that kind of model. And talk about how, you know, children need to grow up with multiple generations present, that families need to take care of their own elderly. So I see these ideas coming from my students a lot. And I was, it really kind of blew me away the first time I saw that because, you know, we think about, if you made a choice in the United States, which kind of family do you prefer? You would have nuclear family and single parent, basically. Mm. But the choice that my students were writing about, and of course Japan has single parent families too, but I thought it was very interesting that so many young people had strong feelings about these three generation households like that.
Well, Micah, why don't you jump in?
Well, I find that really interesting, especially given the fairly substantial demographic pressures that Japan is facing right now with a low birth rate and increased life expectancy, meaning that you've got three, sometimes four generations in the family, and that when you have the great-grandmother in the family, then the role of the kind of the grandparent level goes to the younger children, and then the great-grandparents don't have a role, and then there's weird sociological pressure because they're the senior, so they should have high status, but they don't have a role, which compromises their usability. Versus this here, we see the great-grandmother very much as a matriarch. She wields incredible soft power. And I wonder to what degree this film kind of is at least in part, in some ways, a reminder of the utility and of the great usefulness socially and familially of that great grandparent level of a family.
Yeah, yeah. I see David had his hand up after you, Mike. So why don't you jump in, David?
Well, I guess expanding on that too, because yeah, we do have four generations present in this household mm-hmm. too, and at the same time, we can see. And this may be again part of this film's project of synthesis, because we have most of it does seem to be built up of, I guess, fairly traditional subunits of the two parents and children, but we have, and now I've forgotten our protagonist's name. Kenji, who is he comes from a family where his parents are both absentee essentially, and is absorbed, or I shouldn't say absorbed, is embraced by this family, and we get the sense of this this embrace that's extending and extending and extending when we finally see how many people are brought together, and perhaps initially by the grandmother, and. So we have on the one hand, I guess that traditional multi-generation family, but that can be made up of all kinds of disparate parts that are coming together for a unified project.
Daniel, you had a hand.
Yeah.
It's been reported in a number of places that when the director, Mamoru Hosoda, was in the early planning stages of this movie, he got engaged, and when he went to the countryside to visit his fiance's family for the first time, he was kind of like Kenji. He came from a small family without a lot of connections, and was suddenly found himself surrounded by this, you know, gigantic family, and his head was kind of spinning. Oh, who are these people? What am I doing here? But I think that experience. Had a pretty strong influence on shaping the movie.
Yeah, I mean that seems fairly. I think that's. I didn't know that detail, but it seems fairly obvious that the influence is there. And I do think that the. I mean, in large respect, that this film isn't really. I mean, for me, it's not really about like world catastrophe. Or anything of that nature, even a silly version of a world catastrophe. It's always about this family. I mean, all of the major events that really matter on any personal level occur in the family. And I mean, even the conflicts that we see in the family, the way in which they're resolved. I think one of the characters even says something to the effect like we are family, like we hate each other. I think it's the one the patriotic guy who's like. You know, we got to do it for the fam, for our history, because we were samurai and we whatever. And I think he says almost explicitly, like, you know, having brothers and sisters is a good thing, because you learn to hate them and all these things that don't sound great, but they're actually kind of charming in his own way. But I mean, he's basically just suggesting that this is actually a good thing, having this extended family. We may bicker, but at the end of the day, right, this is a support unit, a massive unit of support. When it comes right down to it, that's what they do. They all come together in support for one another, which, you know, despite the fact that half of them hate each other and want to smack each other around, but they set that aside. So it is an interesting thing to sort of have that in opposition to this, I guess, rabbit fighting giant weird creature avatar thing. And the sort of catastrophe that's associated with that. But I see Paul put a hand up, so why don't you jump in, Paul?
Yeah, I just have a brief tag off of what David was saying, that consider the major resolution besides defeating the AI at the end is that a black sheep, Robusuke, has been reconciled to the family, and Kenji has been welcomed into it.
Yes.
So that's all about this family growing and expanding and welcoming old, lost, and new members. So that family drama, that family conflict, that family dynamic is clearly at the center of this film.
I love how I think we've neglected to mention that she brings Kenji to her family as a job, but to pretend to be her boyfriend because she doesn't want to disappoint the grandmother, the great-grandmother. And so basically has him pretend and lie. And of course, amusingly, they kind of get together in the end, sort of, kind of. He bleeds out his nose, which is a fun anime trope of exploding blood nostrils. I mean, if that were a real true thing, there's a big, big issue with nosebleeds in Japan. But I mean, that's a really amusing trope. But, you know, they end up together and it's cute. But Mike probably has something more interesting to say than what I just said, so.
Well, I listened to the dub, so I didn't have access to the actual Japanese because I remember enough to get myself into trouble. Did anybody listen to this subtitled? Or Daniel, did you see it in the original Japanese?
I did.
Do you remember if the declaration at the end is aishiteru or suki? Like, what degree of declaration of affection between the two is that?
He said daisuki. Which is, I really like you.
Okay, so that's about equivalent to the high schoolers circling each other and then saying that they're interested in each other and then they're going to go out, rather than the declaration of love that will lead to a engagement.
Well, you could probably go either way with that.
Okay.
Because the policeman guy was... You know, when the family gathered around, was kind of pushing them together, the policeman guy is saying, if you say you like her, I'm going to kill you. And he kind of backed off and he said, if you say you hate her, I'm going to kill you. But you know, after being presented with those two options, and the policeman was saying, if you say ski, I will kill you. And he responded and saying, die ski. So. Okay. He was coming back at, you know, with more than the policeman was worried about.
Interesting. Anyway.
So this is our sociolinguistic digression because my understanding is that there's a very particular narrative trope of the declaration of affection in Japanese storytelling, as derived from contemporary culture, that I'm sure Daniel can give me more context on because I'm out of date, that in American TV, we'd probably have a declaration of I love you, mm-hmm. And it's more common in anime and manga to lead up to a declaration of, you know, ski or daisuki, which then kind of opens up a relationship that moves on from there.
Right. The whole declaration thing. I mean, it's certain around in real life too, and they make I don't know when they're ready to take the relationship a certain direction. I think it's kind of expected that there be some kind of, you know, direct declaration, like ski desu or. It's probably ski desu. But
for those of us that don't know Japanese, that word means nothing.
ski desu is it can mean, depending on context, it can mean I like you or I love you. Aishiteru is a little more clear that we're talking about romantic love.
Okay.
But it can be used in other ways. The I love you declarations can get kind of there are many nuances.
Yeah, and that's I wanted to get somebody's take on what the Japanese version was, because the translation is so rough into English. It's harder to get that nuance and context. So I wanted to get a sense of kind of how much narrative momentum the film was giving that relationship. So I'm glad to have that clarification.
Yeah. And that's something I did watch this with subtitles, because I refuse to watch foreign films that are not in English in dubs, because I feel like dubs are evil. So that's kind of a hyperbole, but so I did watch it, but I guess it's something that I would not have picked up on anyway, because they would have translated it into most likely some sort of an American idiom anyway. And that would have been, basically the translation would be its own interpretation. So, yeah. And I don't remember exactly how they translated it, but I'm sure the translation I have is not great because most translations aren't terribly good. But when it comes to, I think this was fan subbed. I don't know. I don't know who did the translations, but online. But in any case, David has a hand.
Actually, I had a question. The card game.
Which
I found completely baffling. But is it a real thing, and how does it work?
Yeah, I had one of that too.
It's definitely a real thing. Not many young people play it. It's more of a game that adults, especially older adults, play. And I don't know the rules myself, so I can't really explain it.
Yeah, because I was baffled too, just like David. I was like, how did she win that? What? I don't understand. She matched the weird circle thing with like the tree. What happened? Yeah.
For me, it was like watching Dane play poker.
Poker makes sense to me, but
it makes no sense to me.
I guess that's one of those things where, like, if you've never seen it played and this is sort of like your first experience, you will be baffled because there are names for the different sequences and, you know, and they don't quite make sense if you don't know what it means.
I mean, of course, it doesn't really make that much of a difference because you get it that, you know, the principle of the bet is clear and, yeah. The, you know, who's winning and who's losing is made absolutely explicit. So, I was just, obviously I'd never encountered it before and was curious.
But that is actually one of the interesting scenes when all the family gets together and it's mostly the young people are getting involved, although some of the older people do try to fight the Kazuma's father sort of shows up and like does this flying ninja kick into the AI's face, which I loved. That was great. But it's mostly the young people. The young people are doing it. And so in her case, she's doing this game. We haven't talked about this, but she's doing this game where she's playing this card game, basically betting accounts because they're trying to get the accounts back so they can get the one account that connects to the GPS system associated with the satellite, which they believe that it is going to crash it into a nuclear power facility, which this is 2009, right? So when exactly was the Fukushima was a few years later, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so never mind. There's nothing there. I was gonna be like, I wonder what this has to do, but no, it doesn't have anything to do with anything in particular. But maybe Paul, you want to jump in here?
I had a question. Maybe Daniel or Michael can answer this. Maybe even reading too much into it. And here we go with the end again. In the end, the satellite crashes down, and you get a geyser. Is the geyser significant as a symbol that I'm just not understanding Japanese culture? Why is it geyser suddenly erupting out of the spot where the satellite crashed? What does that mean, if anything?
It's part of the happy ending, actually, because the Japan has a lot of volcanoes, a lot of volcanic activity, and hot springs are a really big thing in Japan. Hot spring resorts are popular all throughout the country, and the way that I took that is that the impact discovered a previously unknown hot spring on their property, which is going to probably help them rebuild their family fortune by turning their place into a hot springs resort.
Ah,
you've never seen Love Hina, have you, Paul?
No, I have not.
Okay, there's a hot spring in that one. I should mention also there's a lot of nose bleeding in that show for much the same reason.
Okay, then.
the poor character in Love Hina gets in a lot of trouble by being in the wrong place at the, well, I guess depending on your perspective, the right or wrong time, and usually involves the hot spring.
Is that the one where they fall into one hot spring and they become a panda or something?
No.
Oh, okay.
No. Love Hina is just the main character is this young man who is trying to go to Tokyo U and basically becomes the head of this all girls, I guess like a, where like young teenage women trying to go to college or whatever live. I don't know exactly how you would describe it, but it basically has a hot spring. And he he ends up going to the hot spring sometimes when there are women there, and they all think that he's being a pervert, but he's not. He's just an idiot and doesn't check. So, but anyway, that had nothing to do with anything. But David, why don't you jump in?
I just wanted to say, on a completely different note, something that we haven't really touched on before is just how neat the visualizations of Oz are. And Love Machine is a great-looking villain / AI in his various manifestations up to this kind of, you know, the at the climax, this sort of gigantic composite demon form that has some of the same kind of gigantic majesty as the demon in Fantasia, and really quite spectacular. And so quite apart from the the really interesting and fun family story that we're getting as the principal arc, there's some really neat spectacle going on as well.
Stina?
Yeah, I've really loved the color. The use of color is just amazing in that piece. And I really like the animation style. I thought it was rather unique. But then again, I haven't seen a whole lot of anime. But I thought it was beautiful. It was very beautifully done. It was gorgeous.
Yeah, I'll second that on the, particularly the action sequences, which I thought were really, really well done. They just felt very crisp, and they're just really good, I thought, overall, the action sequences. And there are quite a few of them, and they're just really good. A lot of high action, well-paced, more realistic in many respects than one might expect, having myself watch some Naruto. A little bit more realistic in some respects, but yeah. So anyway, but I guess the other thing that we could talk about too is no, I just totally lost it. Never mind. Brain had a fart and just decided it didn't want to work. So sorry. Paul, save me.
I will save you. I just want to make a comment that amused me, that the ending of this, the denouement, reminded me of a Doctor Who episode called Earthshock, although it has a much happier ending. Basically, Kenji using math to try to defeat and try to redirect doom coming down upon them all. I just kept mentally connecting Kenji to Adric for some reason. I don't know why. but without that unhappy ending that Adric gets.
Interesting. Well, Daniel, what about you?
One thing I wanted to bring up is before Mamoru Hosoda kind of became a household name in Japan, I don't know if he's a household name yet or not, but before he got a lot of attention, he did a lot of TV work and also a couple of movies for other franchises. Like, he did a One Piece movie and also a couple of short Digimon movies. And one of his first Digimon movie was called Our War Game, and it has an AI plot that's extremely similar to Summer Wars. So that to the point that as far as the AI plot of Summer Wars, in many ways, it's a remake of his earlier Digimon work. I'd like to recommend that, but unfortunately, I think the American release of that movie is spliced together with another Digimon movie for some reason. So I haven't seen it. I'm not sure how much sense it makes in that condition. But the original one is pretty cool, though, and makes a good comparison for this as well.
Mike, you want to jump in?
Yeah, just kind of jumping back to the card game Hanafuda. I think it's interesting that in the youngest generation, with Kenji and Kazuma and, of course, now I've forgotten the female lead's name, Natsuki. We have a balance between old skills and hyper-modern skills, where we have Kenji, who's a math whiz and puts it to a very modern end, but it has kind of a long history in terms of mathematics and cryptography. We have Natsuki carrying forward the old skill of Hanafuda, which Daniel has, ID'd as a more traditional art. And then we have Kazuma, who's the digital native. so that it's not just that the kids are saving us by being young and hip. It's that the children are bridging the gap and kind of carrying forward the skills of the previous generations. And that's something that kind of only really came together for me when we were talking about Hanafuda. And since we'd already talked about the traditional aspect, I wanted to throw that in as well.
Hmm. Well, when you think about it, I mean, he's a digital samurai.
Mm. Oh, he is, true. Sorry, I think that may have been David's phone. He told us about it earlier. But yeah, but that's interesting when you think of him as he is a digital samurai. And that is actually how he's played off, right? And he does, in a sense, lose many battles.
Yes, he's going into battle against he's actually reenacting the family's history in a way. Because he's just himself, or it's a low number of people going up against many, many millions, you know?
That's right. And even that moment when he talks to his father and the father's telling him about one of the battles in which they lost, and they actually borrow the strategy where they're going to lure Love Machine or the AI, whichever direction you want to call it, into basically a trap and then drown it.
And he refers to his father as sensei. That's what occurred to me.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Mike, you want to jump in on this?
Yeah, and this kind of really plays into what I see and kind of what I've learned about kind of earlier Japanese like hero legends, is that there's a lot of valorization of the loser, that the monogatari, the kind of the war chronicles, are frequently, if not always, titled for the family that loses rather than the victors. So that here we have a family who have very frequently been losers as the heroes of the story, but this time they succeed.
Huh. With plenty of losses along the way.
Yeah. Even Kenji, yeah. This sort of, I guess you could say he's kind of a loser.
Yeah, because he gets his math wrong until the very end when it really counts.
I had a question about that. Why was he on the news again for being the one responsible for giving up giving access to the AI and vandalizing when his code wasn't even correct? When it looked like he was responsible, I was like, okay, so he gave the code to the AI, and that's why they have his picture. But then when we surprised, they got the code wrong. So why was he fingered in the first place? And how?
The only thing I could guess would be that it comes down to he's the one who got it wrong. Like, he got 99% of it right, but then screwed up one thing. So Love Machine might have perceived that as a weakness.
And basically outed him to the authorities, maybe?
Yeah, that's all I got.
No, he takes his avatar.
Right.
That's why they fingered him. They take his avatar.
Right, but why not the other 70 people who do it? Yeah, it just seemed it was convenient for the plot, but.
Oh, Stina may be trying to type hand again. Stina, go.
Go, Stina, sorry.
He took all the avatars for all of the people that actually solved that or attempted to solve it. They explain that. He said anyone who attempted to answer, whether or not they got the answer correctly, the avatar was stolen.
Okay.
And in his case, for some reason, the AI chose him.
My feeling on it was he actually, he confessed, he didn't. I mean, he didn't until it was on television and it was showing his picture, right?
Yeah.
Was he the one in Japan who accepted? Were all the other ones from elsewhere then?
I suspect that that was it, actually, because it does state that they were from everywhere else. So maybe because they were focusing on the events occurring within Japan and other countries' events were alluded to, but it wasn't focused on, which, by the way, is exactly how an American story handles things when you think about it.
Yeah.
So I have no fault. I blame no one for that one anyway. Goes around, comes around. But I strongly suspect that it's because he was the only Japanese person whose avatar was stolen.
Okay, that makes sense. Now that we hashed it out.
Interesting. I don't know. Well, okay, well, it seems like we've mined this pretty good. Unless anyone has any, so why don't we just go any last thoughts that people may have. David may be typing hand as we speak.
Okay. There was one thing that struck me. The weird, at least it sort of struck me as strange, kind of intrafamilial desire with Natsuki kind of lusting after the uncle, in fact giving her fake boyfriend the background of the uncle. For as his cover story, and then the police officer who is her cousin lusting after her. I wasn't quite sure what to make of all that.
Neither was I.
Me neither. That seemed really creepy.
Well, because Shota is, I think, a second cousin to Natsuki.
He's not a first cousin. No, I think you're right. He is a second cousin.
Yeah, so that's second, you know, second cousin is at least one more degree separated. And I don't remember there being any kind of, like, we need to keep the family strong element that would invite that kind of endogamous marriage within the Jinouchi clan.
And no, he's teased about having failed to act on it.
Yeah.
At one point, yeah.
And is Wabusuke the son, the illegitimate son of the great grandmother's husband or of one of her children? Because he's 41, but in the family tree, I see, now this is Wikipedia, so whatever. He's listed he's listed in the same kind of generational row as the grandparent generation.
That makes it even worse somehow.
Yeah. Cause if he's if he was born late into the great grandfather's life and is now 40, versus Natsuki's, you know, 41 versus Natsuki's 18, that means that his position within the family is then problematized because he's as old as the second youngest generation, but he's actually only one generation removed from the matriarch, if I'm reading this chart correctly.
And if that chart is accurate.
Yeah. That sounds correct to me.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. family trees, confusing. Mm. So are we just all on board then that there's just some like really creepy aspects to the relationship, Natsuki with some of the other ones?
Yes.
Her uncle, etc.
Okay. Well, I think when Natsuki was a little girl, maybe she had a crush on the uncle, but as a teenager, I mean, she's very embarrassed by it now.
Well, except she's still sort of hanging on to him, trying to get him to take her with him to the back to the United States. For her ersatz boyfriend, the background that she gives him is her uncle's. Right?
Right.
And so he's basically she's turned him into her uncle for the purposes of his being her fiance.
Psychoanalysis would have a heyday with this.
I'm not sure she's thought it through that far herself, but
I mean, you may be correct on that, Daniel. She may not have, and
the other
maybe others are reading
it.
Into it. But as you guys have already pointed out to me, they read twisted things into things already. Mm. So is this maybe just another thing that they somewhat twist out of proportion?
Maybe. I don't think. I don't know. There's a whole lot of anime out there with twisted relationships, and
at least there aren't any tentacles in this,
right? Well,
exactly.
And but I don't know that it's hard for me to read on what Hosoda's after with that because, it seems like overall he's not aiming to be that kind of anime director. I mean, he seems to me like he's shooting for a wide, you know, a wide mainstream audience.
Yeah.
And too much of that icky stuff is going to alienate that. And so I don't know.
It doesn't play a big role. It's just, it's there. And then we since we have it sort of twice, it leapt out even more at me. I felt like more than, the primary one is with the uncle, but it just it particularly struck me the fact that we had it with two characters centered around the same one. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't quite sure what to make of that.
Well, I did want to jump in because Daniel was suggesting it, and David, and I tend to agree that, granted, I've only watched this one film by this particular director, so I'm talking somewhat out of my ass in saying that I do think he's trying to be a different kind of director. But I mostly say that because of the some of the directing style that appears here. There were some scenes that were just really, really, I thought, cleverly drafted. So, one example... When he returns from America and there's a scene at which we see the family having I can't remember what they're arguing over. They're having a debate or discussion or argument over something at the table. And all we see is immediately the frame of just that, the family. And then we hear his voice and then everything pauses and the screen actually stretches out to show him sort of off to the side outside of the main room. And there are moments like that where the grieving scene when it sort of pans across the entire family in various stages, or in some cases sort of trying not to grieve, there are some playing with children, you know, trying not to let on. There's some really great sort of these sort of little moments, and there are many more. I think if I watched it again, I'd notice other things, but the way he directs that are really like kind of in line with a lot of very serious anime that I mostly was making comparisons in my brain to Makoto Shinkai, who is my favorite anime director, because there were things that I noticed that are similar, although they may not have anything to do with each other, but I'm a little obsessed with Makoto Shinkai, so it's just one of my favorites. But that sort of tone as demonstrated through the directing I thought was really, really interesting, and in some cases rather symbolic as well, but yeah. I make everybody go quiet. This is wonderful. I am the greatest. I can just quiet a crowd. It's great. I should be hired to help babies go to sleep.
Silence 15-foot radius spell at will. Oh, sorry. That would be a mic reference, not a you reference.
It's for everybody.
It's for everybody. Excellent. Well, anyway,
D&D is for everyone.
It is.
Exactly.
So why don't we wrap up then, because we're a little over an hour in terms of how long we've been talking. And I forgot to mention to Daniel that we grade the films on an American letter grade scale from A+ to F-. Pretty sure nobody is going to give this film an F-. So in any case, so we'll start with just sort of final thoughts and grades, and we'll start with you, Mike.
Well, coming into this, I would have given it like a B or B+, but talking about it has really increased my appreciation. So I'm going to give this an A.
Wow. Excellent. All right. What about you, David?
There were some questions I raised about it, but I remember the first time that my stepdaughter sat me down to show me this film, and it was just the sheer enjoyment I got out of it was really quite something. And there's so much really, actually, I don't know what you were pointing out about the framing of the shots, how so much of it is handled. So I'm going to go with the A as well.
Excellent. What about you, Daniel?
A for me too. It hit all my buttons just as a science fiction film and as a fantasy film. It just makes me feel good to watch.
Good. What about you, Paul?
I'm going to sound like a broken record and give it an A as well. I was well entertained. It's well directed. I could have hoped for more female characters besides the matriarch, but she's the real strong center of this film. I had written down, Granny is awesome. And she is. The first half that she's in and the second half that she overshadows. And she as the head of this family is the real star of this film.
Hey. She's the final image of the film too, eh?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, she is.
Mm-hmm. All right, Stina, your turn.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because I was like 15 minutes into the movie and I had written down, Granny is awesome. So I totally did not expect to like this. I really didn't. So it had to bump up against some pretty heavy duty negative thoughts that I had going into it. I have to give it an A. I really do. I do have to give it an A. I thought about giving it an A minus just because of the whole everybody else gave it an A. But I'm going to give it an A.
Well, then I have to be the one that poops on everyone's parade.
No, one has to poop on the parade. No one.
I have to poop on the parade.
There's no requirement here. There's no requirement.
Okay, it's not a requirement, but I am going to end up doing it, and I don't want to, but I have to just a little bit.
You're a free man.
I am a free man, and as a Mike Myers kid, no, I'm not going to make a.
He's not a number. He's a letter grade.
Yeah.
He hasn't seen The Prisoner yet.
No, I have not.
Can that be our title?
No. Anyway, I will say that I like this film a lot. The only thing that I think I did not like was something we didn't talk about, which is that I didn't understand why it was so hard to stop Oz from going haywire. Like, there were aspects where it was showing us these avatars, but it was treating them as though they were, like, actually inside the avatars. But then when you got back out to the real world, it was obvious that they weren't. And so it seemed to me that there was very clearly, like, this clear disconnect in the world from, like, the sort of Oz world and the real world. And I didn't understand why someone didn't just go to, like, the Oz network somewhere and just pull the plug, which is sort of a plot hole that never really gets answered for me.
Well, because everything is so now wired into it that it would be like pulling the plug on the internet.
Well, but as soon as it gets access to, like, you know, your nuclear power facilities or your weaponry, I mean, that sucks that, you know, you're going to be late to go get your groceries because you have to walk. But that it's either that or potential doom for everyone.
Yeah, so but I mean, how would you, you know, for instance, just today, you know, if you something got effectively into the internet, which is what Oz pretty much is, how intricately everyone's lives is part of it. So if something like Love Machine got in and was decided, okay, we now have to turn off the internet completely, think of the haywire that would ensue. Right, because we, at least certainly in a lot of our societies, we'd be completely paralyzed. Just think how difficult it is if you got no Wi-Fi for an hour.
I disagree.
Where would they unplug it?
Well, I mean, there has to be like a central facility. I guess the thing is maybe it is there, but the. Maybe the issue is it sets up that this thing is all encompassing and it tries to present it as though it is, but there's, I guess it's not in many respects far enough removed from our present in terms of its visuals in the real world to sort of suggest that we're at a point where we really, really can't exist without this system. I guess is the thing I would get because at some point, like they know that there are things called maps, right? So they have to at least figure out, okay, can't trust Oz because it's on the fritz. We're going to have to actually figure out, like, where we need to take right turns and, like, write it down on a piece of paper.
So you're applying a hard SF requirement to a story featuring an AI called Love Machine fighting a ninja bunny?
yes.
Okay.
This is the central gimme of the film. They do an entire intro that says, this is how important Oz is. Like, if you're not going to give the film any gimmies, then I think that criticism is fine. But it's very traditional in my experience for science fiction is that you accept one ridiculous thing, and then you get to tell a fun story.
And that's the opening crawl.
It is the opening crawl. I'm not saying it destroys... Like, you're all treating it like I'm making this criticism, and, like, he's going to give it an F-, and he hates this movie, and Daniel will never be allowed on the show ever again. No.
But you're throwing feces on the parade.
No, I'm just saying...
Yeah, we're in the grading sequence.
We are in the grading sequence, and I said I had to poop on it a little bit.
And like, he is a monkey. He is a monkey.
No, I'm not a monkey. I wasn't throwing it around. I just had just a little... this was the thing that for me just it moves it down to an A-, because it's just one critical flaw, and I needed that not to, I needed that, like, why is it that the, like, I don't, I guess, like, if the avatars in the beginning, it made it seem like the avatars were, like, you went in there and you really did feel the experience. In fact, the narration in the beginning says that you, like, you feel it. You feel, like, living in this place. And that isn't something that is actually part of the real narrative. So I guess it's just a disconnect. So it's an A-. Please don't hate me.
No. You're entitled to your own opinion, John.
But we'll still silently hate you.
I'm not going to hate Sean.
Daniel might hate me.
I don't hate you.
Oh, okay. This is good. Awesome. I've made new friends.
Yay.
Okay, anyway, I'm sorry. That's total sidetrack. So real quick before we close awkwardly, Daniel, do you have any, do you have websites where people might hunt you down and stalk you? Like, nicely, you know, not in any way that you would need to... Let me just rephrase that. Do you have any place on the internet where people can find you? That would be the other thing. And since you do translation work, you might want to maybe point to some recent stuff you've done.
Okay. I really don't have a website. I'm on Facebook, but aside from that, no real internet presence. As far as translations, I've done two books for Viz's Haikasoru imprint. One is Virus by Komatsu Sakyo. It's a story about a killer virus out of control, running over, overrunning the world. And the second is Apparitions, Ghosts of Old Edo, which is a collection of short ghost stories by Miyabe Miyuki. Before that, I also did one short story for anthology called Speculative Japan 3, which is published by Kurodahan Press. And its title is Fin and Claw in English.
Excellent. Well, that means everybody should go check out those particular books and obviously the collection which the story you translated is in. They should check all of those out. So in any case, I do find it amusing that we were just talking about the internet being ubiquitous, but you have kept yourself out of it, Daniel.
Hmm.
It's probably for the best. You'll survive.
He knows better than us.
You'll survive the AI apocalypse.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If I spend too much time with it, I will not get any translating or writing done. So
there's that too. Awesome. Well, all right, guys. So that's about it. So I just want to say thanks to Mike for joining us for this episode. Thank you, Mike.
Very fun. Good to bring my Japanese chops out again.
Thank you, David, for the same.
Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
And thank you, Stina.
Thank you.
And thank you, Daniel, for suggesting the film and coming on and talking to us about it.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I'm glad you all liked it.
All right, and we will see everybody next time. So, awkward ending. And
good night,
scene.
Everyone.
No, there's no good nights. It's just, it ends. It
I
ends.
I stepped on your head. I stepped on your awkwardness.
It's done.
You gotta
it's,
make it awkward.
It's done. I'm just gonna mute Paul's line when he says good night. There's no good nights.
You really raised the bar on awkwardness there.
Maybe I'll just leave that part in. If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.
Hey everybody, welcome to the World SF Tour, our special feature throughout the year in which we're obviously celebrating World SF.
There are a number of ways you could support this show, just really quick. One is you could subscribe to the show. We're on iTunes, we have the blog, all that good stuff. There's all kinds of cool stuff in the blog, too, you should check out. That's one way you could support us. You can obviously let people know about us. That's really cool when people do that, link to us and all that good stuff. And the other way is actually to go to audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty, sign up for 1 month free trial membership. You get a free audiobook out of the deal. You get to try their service if you like it, to keep it, which is cool. And that, I mean, that's really that simple. So that helps us as much as the rest of it does. But in any case, thank you for listening. I really hope you enjoy this year, this very specially themed year. And of course, if we missed anything, which we're undoubtedly going to do, feel free to let us know. Send us an email or leave a comment or something. Maybe even on some of our discussion episodes, you let us know about some great works from a certain region that we should be talking about. So in any case, I'll let you get to the episode, and I hope you enjoy it.